I was working in this area as a war correspondent for years before I became. I didn't have a clue that this was happening on this kind of scale.
So, Christina Lamb, welcome to How the Light Gets In.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So you've had a very distinguished career as a foreign correspondent, particularly as a war correspondent. And one of the things you focus in on is the impact on women in the context of war. Can you tell us what is it that we learn about warfare when we look at the impact it has on women that other sort of coverage of war misses?
Sure. I mean, I feel strongly that the story of women in war has gone untold for a very long time. And when you read military histories that are usually written by men, it's as if war is just about men fighting on the battlefront. Of course, that is a big aspect of war, but there's a lot more. And to me, the most interesting thing about war is how people live during a war, how they keep life together, how they feed children, protect the elderly, shelter them. The people that are doing that are the women. And they don't really get the credit. You don't see statues for what women did in the war. And so I don't know whether it's because I'm a woman that I always have talked to women much more on the battlefront areas, or maybe also I'm not so brave and it's actually I'm more interested in not being in the middle of the fighting, but actually talking to the people living in the areas. I also think people often forget that when a war is going on, it isn't just all about the fighting. There are still millions of people getting married, having babies, going to work. And in Ukraine today, you see that all the time.
Mm-hmm. So women are in some ways largely carrying the burden of continuing the life to daily life when, you know, men are off fighting their wars. And,
absolutely. And so to me, you know, that's just as heroic. Of course, now there are some women fighting too. Ukraine, there are, are women on the front, but it is still largely men that are fighting.
Even if women aren't fighting actively in wars, they're often the casualties of war. And one of the sort of darker parts of that is sexual violence in the context of war. You've written in the Times about how rape is the unspoken weapon in every conflict that you've covered. Why is it an unspoken crime and why are people so reluctant to talk about it?
Absolutely. Well, I think part of it goes back to what I said earlier, that people have not engaged with the women so much during war, and whether that's because in the past, a lot of the reporters were male reporters, or whether it was just something people didn't think about. May also be, you know, that women didn't talk about it so much. It's a difficult thing to talk about.
Involved.
Yeah. So, you know, I was doing this job for years before I really became aware of how big an issue it was. And I would say only really about 2014, so 10 years ago, by which time I'd been doing the job 25 years, was when I realized just how big an issue this was. And that was a number of things that were happening around the same time. You might remember the Chibok girls that were taken from their school in the middle of the night in Nigeria, around 250 girls, and taken into the Sambisa forest by Boko Haram fighters. And that became sort of the biggest story on earth for a couple of weeks, largely because people like Michelle Obama held up these plaques saying, "Bring back our girls." And it became this most tweeted hashtag. And unfortunately, after a couple of weeks, everybody then just moved on. And in fact, 10 years on, more than half those girls are still being held. But I then started traveling a lot in northeast Nigeria to try and find out why it was happening, and discovered that this was just the tip of the iceberg, that tens of thousands of girls and women had been taken. And horrifying stories that they were kept as so-called bushwives by Boko Haram fighters. And some of them had been rescued by Nigerian soldiers, but then when they were rescued, often the Nigerian soldiers raped them. And then when they were taken to IDP camps back to their communities, often the communities wouldn't take them back because they saw them as somehow solid or brainwashed, bringing shame on their families. And this is one of the really sad aspects of this issue, that people who are actually victims are being treated as if they did something wrong. So there was that happening in 2014. But then around the same time, in August of 2014, was the ISIS fighters going into Shingal in northern Iraq and capturing thousands of Yazidi women and girls, killing lots of Yazidi men and elderly, but enslaving as sex slaves these Yazidi, young Yazidi women. So I met some of those women who had been rescued, who escaped, and I had never heard such terrible stories in my life. I mean, they had been taken to a place known as Galaxy Cinema in Mosul, which was basically like a market for sex slaves, where they were all kept and fighters would come in and touch their hair, touch their breasts, decide which girl they wanted to take. And some of those girls I met had been traded over and over again. One girl I met had been traded 12 times. She said she felt like cattle. Mm. And she tried to kill herself a number of times and actually didn't succeed. And she said even death didn't want me. So these stories were horrifying. But, you know, the women were actually coming forward and talking about them, and we were reporting them. And a couple of years after that, you might remember 2017, when the Rohingya people were attacked in Myanmar or Burma by Burmese military and Buddhist militia, who would come into the villages, set fire to the huts, kill the men, and then grab the women, tie them to banana trees and gang rape them, often in front of their children. So around 700,000 people fled from that area in 3 months. And I was in Bangladesh on the other side where they were fleeing to. And mostly they were women and children. And all the women were coming with the same kind of stories of what happened. So within a few years, we had so many of these cases. And I was horrified. And so I was writing about it. I have to say that my male foreign editor at the time said to me, nobody wants to hear these stories. They're too horrible. And I'm like, my job is to, if we don't make people aware of uncomfortable things, nothing will change. Mm. So I really fought. And it was something, you know, you really didn't read much reporting of. So I was very disturbed and angry, really, at what was happening. And then one day, one of the Yazidi girls that I had interviewed sent me a WhatsApp message saying, we told our story. What happened? What difference did it make? And I couldn't answer the question. I just thought, my God, you know, actually, yeah, you all, these really difficult stories you told us, and we wrote, and nobody did anything. And when I looked into it, not a single person had been prosecuted in any of those cases, whether it was over the Yazidis, over the Rohingyas, over the girls taken in Nigeria. And we are talking about hundreds of thousands of women. Yeah. So I was horrified. And that's what made me really start focusing on this much more.
Do we learn anything about, now knowing more about these stories, do we learn anything about the conditions that enable sexual violence to take place in the context of warfare? Do you see any patterns emerging that it happens in some cases, it doesn't happen as much in other cases? Do we learn some things about how to prevent them from happening, apart from maybe the legal way that we'll get to in a minute?
Well, sadly, I mean, when I looked into it, I found that it just seems to happen in every conflict. There was pretty much no conflict where it didn't happen. And many conflicts. So I looked back into the history too of wars, and many conflicts where it wasn't really reported at the time, actually it was happening a lot. So the Spanish Civil War, for example. Mm. I mean, people were, and I'm particularly looking at rape as a weapon of war. So where fighters are actually like ordered to rape the enemy. And because, I mean, some people will say rightly that there's always been rape in war, you know, rape and pillage. You go back to ancient Romans, the Greeks, you read Herodotus, it starts with. So, you know, what's new? Well, first of all, we're in 2024, so I'm not sure that it's an argument to say, well, these things were always happening. So the fact they're still happening. So what? I think hopefully we've moved on a bit. But as I said, I particularly focused on it being used as a weapon. And so in the Spanish Civil War, for example, you have officers like giving radio messages to their soldiers to rape the enemy. And certainly in these more recent cases, ISIS with the Yazidis were actually like issuing licenses for the women, and they issued handbooks of how to treat your sabia, your sex slave. So there is plenty of evidence about it.
Do you think we need to reconceptualize how we think about sexual violence and rape? I mean, it's obviously a horrendous thing, and there is a shock sort of element to it. But do we think of it as bad as torture, for example? How should we reconfigure our thinking around it?
I think that's a good question. There's one of the heroes in my book is a man called Dr. McCreggy, Dennis McCreggy, who is a gynecologist in the Democratic Republic of Congo, who set up something called the Panzi Hospital. And he and his hospital, I believe, have treated more rape victims than anyone on earth. They've had more than 55,000 women and girls who have been raped. And he won the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago with Nadia Murad, the Yazidi, for their work on sexual violence. And he said to me, you know, people came and awarded us this and applauded my speech, but nothing changed. And I didn't do this to get some kind of award. Yeah. But one of the things he said to me was, do you think if hundreds of thousands of men were being attacked by women and having their genitals mutilated, being left traumatized for life, that nobody would be doing anything? And I think that's a good question. And you know, many of the women I spoke to said to me that they would rather have been killed than go through what they did. And yet, when it comes to cases at the end of wars and tribunals, usually the rape is considered as a kind of side issue, not as something as important as the killing or torture, even though it is officially a war crime. Mm. And I went to the cases that were being held in Iraq for ISIS fighters and spent a day at the court. I mean, they're not kind of cases as we know them. They're like every 20 minutes somebody is tried and often sentenced to death. But they were all being tried on terrorism charges. So I asked the Chief Justice, did none of these people take Yazidi women? And so he said, well, yeah, loads of them did. So I said, well, why isn't that one of the charges? He literally laughed. He said to me, but why would we charge them for that? They also, you know, killed people and tortured people. And I said, don't you understand that for the women, what happens to them was worse than this? And he really didn't.
So what you're saying is there's an element of sexism essentially involved.
I do. I honestly think that one of the problems and why we could talk about the justice thing, but accountability is the exception, not the rule. Very few people are brought to justice. And I think that one of the reasons is that at the end of conflicts, when people sit down and draw up peace agreements and look at kind of how to deal with the justice side, it's almost always men. There is no woman heading a peace agreement around the world. Most peace negotiations don't have women even on them. So they're not thinking about that at all. And so I spend an awful lot of time trying to make people much more aware. But I do think that there is a bit more awareness now, and that's partly because of Ukraine, which we could talk about.
I mean, sexual violence against men might be more rare in the context of war, but it certainly does happen. I was recently listening to this new serial podcast series about Guantanamo Bay and many of the people that ended up being inmates there had been tortured and raped during various parts of their captivity. Does male sexual violence on males get taken more seriously in the context of at least the legal framework?
I mean, I think it's even more taboo, as you say. Right. Very few people come forward. And so I'm not really aware of anyone being brought to justice for that. But that's partly because, I mean, the few women that have succeeded in getting justice usually have had to go over and over again to testify. And I don't think that many people would be prepared to do that. I actually interviewed one of the people who'd been in Guantanamo, Mauritanian, and who's known because he was supposedly the most tortured person, and he was held there for maybe 16 years without charge before finally being released, and he'd been waterboarded, everything. So I interviewed him and I said to him, I asked him about the waterboarding and like what was the worst thing that he went through, and he said to me the sexual violence, and I had no idea, he'd never spoken about it, and I had no idea that that had happened. So I said, what do you mean? And he said that the American female guards had sexually assaulted him. And he said to me, I just can't, I find it really difficult to live with. I can't bear intimacy. I felt objectified. All of the things that the women say. But so that was really shocking. So, you know, we tend to think that it is an issue perpetrated by men on women, but it does happen the other way around.
Or men on men, I guess, sometimes as well. I mean, there's a sense that people think warfare is moving to this sort of like modernized version where robots are going to be fighting each other or drones, and the human element will recede in the background, will be sitting in rooms pressing buttons. You've been to Ukraine recently. I heard you say some bits of it look like First World War trenches.
Yeah.
Is warfare changing in your mind, or are we still basically where we were earlier in the last century?
I mean, Ukraine is this strange example because it does look like First World War trenches in the east. It's muddy fields and men in these sort of foxholes. But then they're using the latest sophisticated drones. And I read the other day more people now are being killed by drones in that war than in any other, by any other means. But that the fact is that in recent years, civilians have been by far the biggest victims in wars. So we're seeing lots of wars fought in urban spaces. You could look at Gaza now. And so when you've got wars in civilian areas, civilians are not just being killed, but you're also seeing rape of civilians. And that's what we saw in Ukraine when Russia occupied some of the areas around Kyiv. When they were driven out, the stories that we heard from women of how they'd been treated and the rapes, and actually also of a young boy as well, were horrific. But that was interesting because that was the first time in all the time I've been reporting that rape in war was widely reported. Everybody was reporting it. And I mean, it sounds a bit weird to call it a positive, it's sort of grim positive, but it did feel like, okay. And also there's the whole issue. Are people more interested because it's in Europe? It's people like us, you know, whatever the reason, if it's made people more aware of the issue, I think we have to take it as a good thing.
Take it seriously. But those women who were telling you their stories were asking, is awareness enough? Do you think it will eventually lead to some change, either at the legal level or at a level of militaries taking it a lot more seriously and not, you know, being so willing to partake in acts of sexual violence during warfare?
Well, I'm a journalist and my job's all about kind of spreading awareness. So I've got to believe that making people aware is the start of things. And as I said, you know, I was working in this area as a war correspondent for years before I didn't have a clue that this was happening on this kind of scale. So I don't know, was it not happening as much until 10 years ago? Was it happening people weren't speaking about it? Was it that we didn't ask the questions? That's difficult for me to know. But what I do know is it has been happening, sadly, on a really big scale over the last 10 years. And yet nobody really is brought to justice for it. I mean, I was just with some Yazidi women the other day. It will be 10 years this August since this happened to them. At the time, you know, the world was full of never again, and this is outrageous, and we must do something. And there were so many stories about what happened to these women. And as I say, now one person only has been brought to justice, which was in Germany. And that is interesting because a German prosecutor was very innovative in using this universal jurisdiction where you can try somebody for war crimes in any country. It doesn't have to be where the crime took place, and they don't have to be from your country. So a German court prosecuted an Iraqi for something he did to a Yazidi in Iraq, and he's now in jail in Germany. So that's very interesting because that means other people could do, other countries could do this.
Your work, as we've discussed, obviously has some sort of dark elements to it, reveals the dark side maybe of human nature. How do you personally deal with that? What do you do to unwind after you've been to a war zone and have been reporting on essentially what are war crimes? How do you cope with all that?
Well, I come to beautiful places like this, and I think nature is very healing. But also, I think I'm very blessed in a way, because sometimes people say to me, how do you deal? Like, you spend all your time in bad places writing about bad people doing bad things. But actually, in those places, you meet people doing remarkable things too. And in a strange way, that gives you a lot of faith in humanity, because you see, even if on a small scale, people are doing things to help their neighborhood or their people on their street. And I just endlessly marvel at how that seems to happen. So I just actually came back from South Africa and did a story I loved doing, which was about an artist who lived next to a park in Johannesburg called the Wilds, which had become a complete no-go area. Everybody said, you can't go there, you'll be raped, murdered, robbed. Nobody went there. And he got a dog, and he kept thinking, why am I having to drive 20 minutes to walk my dog when I'm right next to this park? So he got a key and went in, and he was terrified. He said he just went like 50 meters thinking, I'm going to be murdered. But then after a while, he thought, actually, I mean, why would murderers go to a park where nobody goes? There's nobody to murder. So he started going a bit further and like cutting the undergrowth. And this man on his own led a whole movement to now to turn this park around. And it's now the most beautiful place to go. And it's full of people enjoying it, families. And that's all just because of one man and his dog. So just, I love finding things like that. It's what keeps me going in my job.
Christina Lam, thank you very much.
Thank you.